speaker tonight is someone whom I just met for the first time tonight, though we spoke on the phone in arranging for her to be here, that is Nadia Bilbasi Charters. Nadia is a Washington Bureau senior correspondent responsible for the White House and the State Department for Al Arabiya Satellite TV channel. She has traveled extensively in the United States covering major stories, including the primaries and the presidential campaign, has interviewed both George and Laura Bush in two separate features. She gives her citizenship as Palestinian and Irish, and two strikes against her. And in the past she has worked with MBC, the Middle East Broadcasting Center, as the Nairobi, Kenya bureau chief, and also for MBC TV in Addis Ababa as the Horn of Africa correspondent. She's also a freelance journalist in Dakar, Senegal, working for numerous publications while on maternity leave. She worked for the Independent newspaper and IPS in Colombo, Sri Lanka, BBC Arabic Service in London, the Agence France-Presse in Jerusalem Bureau, the International Committee of the Red Cross, for which she was a local officer, and she is fluent in her native language, her mother tongue of Arabic, in English, and in excellent speaking and writing ability in French, and also knows Hebrew and Swahili. A frequent participant at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Diplomacy, she also has lectured on U.S. foreign policy and defense issues in numerous fora, nationally and internationally, in the United States, the National Defense University, the Army War College, the American University Law School, George Mason University, among others. Nadia Bilbasi Charters.
I'll have a challenge in putting this one on.
That's good.
I don't know if this is good enough. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
I was just thinking of the greeting, and I'm thinking, what a better way to start than saying peace be upon you, as opposed to hi or hello or, you know, all the other words that we use. Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm honored to be here tonight. Thank you, Imad. Thank you for all the panelists, and thank you for coming. It will be a very hard act to follow, having Carol ahead of me, and lots of things we have actually shared in terms of the subject that we're going to talk about, because both of us are journalists. But I will start by a few antidotes. One of them is a story I did in Dearborn in Michigan. I went there to do the what we call the human interest stories or the positive stories. And it was about the first Muslim judge in the United States. It was a fantastic woman. She's great in every aspect, beautiful, intelligent, and she became the first woman judge in the 9th district, I think. And I went to report the story, and in the process, I met the imam of the mosque there in Dearborn. And I asked him, what's the main issues that challenges you as a Muslim here? What's the most common question that people ask you here? And do they really know about Islam? And he said, you'll be very surprised what people ask me here. I go and give speeches all over the country. And I said, well, what's the challenge? And he said, people don't know the difference between Muslim and Islam. And it's just amazing. I mean, if you're going to start from this premise that people don't know. And I think the major challenge that faces all of us, not just as a journalist, but also as public, is ignorance. And it's true. Everywhere you go, I'm amazed. I mean, as maybe Ahmad said, I worked all over the world. I worked in Asia and in Africa and Europe. But I never seen a nation that's so ill-informed as much as I've noticed it in America. And I don't know what it is, whether it's lack of intellectual curiosity, whether it's a superpower that you're miles away from everybody else and you can have your own mentality of people should know about me but I shouldn't know about the world, or people work long hours and therefore they don't have time to read foreign news or to know about what's happening outside. I don't know what it is, but I always say that the most interesting conversation I have in Washington are with the taxi drivers, because, I mean, they're all Ethiopians and Nigerians, and everybody listen to NPR and have the Post or the New York Times in the back seat. It's just amazing. The other thing that I also noticed when I first, I've been here almost 4 years in the summer, I was covering the election of Schwarzenegger as the governor of California. And I was back on a plane from California to Washington, and next to me was a man who was, you know, I mean, Americans are friendly, by the way, which is, you know, all that, but they're always trying to have a conversation with you. Sometimes they give you too much details that I'm always shocked, but anyway. So he said to me, where are you from? And I said, what do you do? And I said, I'm a journalist. And he said, who do you work with? And I said, I'm not going to tell him Al-Arabiya because he wouldn't know. So I said, I work for an Arabic television. And he said, oh, so you're a Muslim? And I said, yeah. He said, okay, so why do you hate us? And I said, we don't hate you. What do you mean you? He said, all of you there, you know, all the Arabs, Muslims, they all hate us. And I said, no, actually, we disagree probably with your, we disagree with your foreign policies, but actually, they like America. People love America. If you look in any Arab countries or any Muslim country, you see lines of people waiting to get a visa to come to America. And a colleague of mine, actually, at Jordan University, did a research about, despite the fact that the height of the problem with France over wearing the hijab in schools, every time they ask me questions about foreign policy, America comes right at the end, and France and Britain comes on the top. But every time people were asked whether they want to migrate to America, whether they want to receive medical treatment, or they wanted to go to school or to study at college or whatever, America comes on top. And I think that sums up the whole concept of dichotomy of how the Muslim and the Arab world look at America. So I think generally, number one, the first challenge that people have or journalists have here is ignorance. People don't know. And sometimes, of course, ignorance is not an excuse. It's not a bless, actually. And as I say, if you're a superpower and you're involved heavily in the Middle East, you have a major invasion of Iraq, you have a threat against Iran and Syria, all the news in the Middle East is coming from here. And in a way, yes, people in the Middle East and elsewhere want to know what's happening in Washington, and we report daily, particularly for my job, we report daily from what's happening from here, because any decision is taken in Washington, it will affect people in Damascus or in Tehran or in Amman or in Jerusalem, and therefore we need to know what's happening. But also I notice, I can talk about Fox News, I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, when we first came here, the attack against what is called now as the Arab pan-Arab satellite television, which is mainly Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera, is enormous. You cannot go anywhere, maybe Al Jazeera to a bigger extent than us. But lecturing about fair reporting, about putting propaganda on the air, inflaming sentiments of people, etc. And you come to America and you see the reporting on Fox News and you are horrified to see this is really serious journalism. So I think in addition to the ignorance, there is an agenda and there is no doubt about it. I mean, it's wonderful to have a democracy and, of course, something that we don't have in the Middle East. And therefore, you have outlets of newspapers and broadcasts from extreme right to extreme left. But in the same time, I think sometimes it is it meant to be this way. And in a world that you live after 9/11, then everything is magnified. But saying that, if you look and examine the Muslim community in America as comparison to Europe, for example, it's extremely well integrated. They see themselves as Americans probably more than the identity of being Muslims comes to the surface, while in Europe they've been treated and seen as minorities and they have enormous problems. Of course, there is a different historical context of the immigrants in France, for example, whether from North Africa or even Pakistanis or Muslims from the ex-India subcontinent in Britain. But looking at the Muslims here, I think it's amazing of how they're not being used as a good example of the fact that it is the faith that separate them, but the fact that they unite as American, as an identity, as a nationalism that you don't see elsewhere in the world. But there is no doubt 9/11 has changed the way people perceive Muslims in this country. And you know the immediate attack after 9/11 of Sikhs being pulled out of stations because they see a turban on their heads and they think, oh, they're Muslims, you know, so we can beat them up or threaten them, whatever. Women has been discriminated against because they wear the hijab. There are many incidents until now, and it's been going up, and sometimes it stabilizes and it goes up again recently. So the media has not been innocent of trying to report certain aspect, and especially every Muslim is a terrorist, and this is how they see it, unfortunately. On top of that, when you have certain words have been applied, and I will focus in particular on the word Islamophobia or Islamic fascist. We have seen even the president using this word. And I always say the fear of using this word, although the hijackers of 9/11 and the people who belong to Al-Qaeda or extremist Muslim groups have to be condemned, and they have to be condemned in a very loud voices. It's not just hushed voices, and it's not among us, but you have to speak loud as much as you can condemn anti-Semitism. It goes for everybody who's basically trying to kill innocent people or see this grotesque pictures that we have seen on our television screens coming from Iraq of beheading and killing and the blood that so much has been recently in our living rooms just seen through, perceived through television screens. But it goes both ways. As much as we wanted the Americans to treat us fairly and to look at us the way we are and to eliminate the extremists as a minority, that they actually don't represent Islam the way we know it. The same time, also I agree with Carol that Muslims have a job to do, and it's not being done very well, because in general, I mean, as a Palestinian, I will say we're not really good in propaganda, or we're not very good in advertising ourselves. We're not very good in putting the point of view across. But also, you Muslim organizations in America know that after 9/11, there have been condemnation. But still, we don't hear it. I mean, you might have the Mufti of Al-Azhar, or you have imams here and there, but it does not take away from our rights, from our justice to have, for example, whether we have a deserve a Palestinian, an independent Palestinian state, or ending the occupation in Iraq, whatever causes that we're fighting for. It doesn't take away from that cause when you see atrocities and you see killing, that Muslims should condemn it, and in the loudest voice possible. We don't see it among Arab intellectuals, unfortunately. You don't read it very much in Arab televisions, in Arab newspapers, or you don't hear it on televisions. And that's a minus. One time, I think it was after the Beslan massacre of almost 300 kids in Chechnya, I think.
In the Caucasus.
In the Caucasus. It is just we had one or two voices saying, who are these people? Why are they killing in the name of Islam? How can taking these kids and blowing them up and keeping them as hostages is representing Islam? And it's the same. It goes the same for even the killing that goes in Iraq. I mean, we have to make the distinction between, I think, legitimate resistance against occupation and killing for the sake of killing. I mean, we're talking about the difference between Sunni and Shiites, and unfortunately now, which is I'm appalled by the way, when we just talk about the difference. But also this term has been sharpened. Maybe the division was there, but it's sharpened to an alarming degree now. That even in American media report, when they talk about the Sunnis, they start talking about the Sunnis in Egypt and the Sunnis in Jordan. And I mean, this was never used. It was always seen as you call people by their nationality, but you never call them by their religion, and definitely you don't call them by their sect. So, of course, people's identity is more in focus and it's sharpened when it's under threat, and that is no doubt about that. But again, it plays into the hands of people don't know what they're talking about, and it goes on and on and on. And therefore, I think, in general, there's so many challenges that we can try to counter for us as journalists in particular. I always say that for us as Al Arabiya, which is a relatively new station, it's been on air for 4 years, that it's first and foremost for journalists is to be professional. And if you're a professional, it means you have to be objective. And to be objective, you to report what you see in front of your eyes. Otherwise, if you're going to color it and put opinion, then you're not a journalist. Then you're an advocate. And if you're an advocate, you can join a political organization or a pressure group. But when we, for example, when I have a problem with terminology as well. I mean, the word terrorist, for example, or has been used. I mean, we know that his terrorist is somebody else's or hers, somebody else's freedom fighter. And therefore, even the UN cannot come up with a definition for terrorism. But also the word massacre and shaheed. I always say, if three Palestinians die, it's not a massacre. It's bad enough that one person died, and we should report it as one death. But you don't call it a massacre, because a massacre is not three people. So we have to be a little bit more accurate. And I always say that, and we're trying to do, as our slogan actually in Al Arabiya, if I do a little bit of advertising for our station, is the slogan is Aqrab ila al Haqiqa, which is closer to truth. Because we don't have monopoly over truth, and nobody does, and there is no one single truth. And therefore, we're trying to set the standard for objective reporting. But as much as we struggle to do that, and we always say we have to be very much journalists before you are anything else, it's very hard to detach yourself as a person from any scene that you can in front of you, especially if you're reporting in Palestine or in Iraq. Or in my case, I mean, I've seen so many cases in southern Sudan when you cover famine and starvation and dead children in front of you. It's very hard not to be sympathetic to these causes. But as much as you can, you're trying to report what you see rather than what interpret it the way that you think the viewer should see it. But vice versa, I found the opposite actually. I mean, of course, you have excellent journalism in terms of print media in this country, you know, the Post and the Times and whatever. But even coming from Europe, I think European paper, with due respect, they are superior in quality in terms of trying to analyze foreign news and trying to report fairly on the news, and still behind the American media, you know, somehow. But generally speaking, if you go back to how we address the challenges, it's an enormous task. It's enormous, especially for television. I mean, television, as you know, it eats money. I mean, we can, certain times we don't do stories. I'm over the time, I think. I have 5 minutes. See, that problem with having journalists around, they always talk too much. And I didn't even write the stuff. The problem for us always is trying to cover the news, but also I always say the worst censorship that we have is self-censorship. It's not that we you see, but we you don't see. That sometimes we don't report on certain stories because of our biases. And that's the most dangerous form of censorship, I would say. For television in particular, the challenge is bigger than for the print media. I mean, for us to get people to talk and to appear on television and to tell us their side of the story, because television is pictures. If you have no pictures, you have no story. You might have the greatest story in the world, but if you don't have the pictures, then that's it, it's the end of the story. And also, I mean, now we have seen the rise of the Arab satellite media in form of some kind of independence. We are miles away from being perfect, but it's the beginning. And the beginning is moving away from government-controlled media. But these television stations need money. I need a hell of a lot of money, I can tell you. So to cover certain stories, money always a consideration, and sometimes it restricts the way that we report in general. But saying that, I'm talking in general here, but even on certain stories, sometimes like the judge in Detroit, it's a great story about how Muslims has been elevated to the highest position in the state. But I can't cover another story because maybe my budget won't allow me to do it. So somehow we are affected by that, and I don't cover the story because of budgetary consideration, nothing more and nothing less. There is also the stereotype. I mean, part of the ignorance also stereotyping that people don't know. I mean, Muslims, as you say, you can see them from all kind of shades of colors and forms. You can have women with hijab, you can have women without hijab. And people always, I mean, they always ask me, so are you a Muslim? And I said, yes, I am. And he goes like, but you don't look a Muslim. So, I mean, the stereotyping of certain images of what a Muslim should look like. And again, I think this is could be done with the work of an influence of certain groups trying to present what Islam is all about. But again, there is no doubt that after 9/11, the world has changed, and unfortunately changed for the worse. It's extremely, the negative effect is very hard to erase overnight. It takes a while, and it takes a huge effort from people trying to change this image. And I leave lots of stuff for Q&A, so for later.